Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Pamela Brewer welcoming you to this edition of Friday on the Other Side here at Mind Talk. And what are we going to be looking at today? We're going to look at sleep. I am happy to introduce to you Dr. Roger Washington, who is the author of Dr. Why Am I Sick? Lack of Sufficient Sleep Matters. Decode the Root Cause of Your Illness. Dr. Roger Washington, it's very nice to have you here on Mind Talk.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Now, you have written a book, and the first thing that I see on the cover is somebody asking you why you're sick, and then you start to talk about sleep. And I'm not sure that a lot of folks think, I mean, we have the sense that you should get a certain amount of sleep and that it's good and it's better for you, but I don't know that we have any sense that poor sleep or failure to get adequate sleep equals getting sick. So your book kind of explodes some theories, I would suggest.
Yes, I think so. That's exactly the reason I wrote the book. My concept was that people underestimate the importance of sleep and the importance of getting sufficient sleep in particular. People have their own belief systems about sleep, their own experience with sleep, and I think that people don't pay enough attention to how important sleep is with regard to maintaining health. And I wrote about how important sleep is by describing how lack of sleep causes illness.
Well, you start off with talking about some of the main things that we as a society really think of when we think about root causes of illness. You talk about germs, you talk about genetics, you talk about stress. Those all seem to be things that we get that, we understand that, and we're growing in our, I think, awareness that stress can cause physical discomfort and illness. Walk us through, if you would, why germs and genetics and stress aren't what you're referring to when you answer the question why someone is sick.
Right. Well, when I started off I was an illness doctor. I went to Stanford's medical school. I became a family doctor, a primary care physician. My goal was to try to help my patients improve on their illness. But eventually I came to the idea that I wanted to try to help them prevent themselves from becoming ill. And so what I did was I paid close attention and listened carefully to when my patients talked about when they became ill, and I made a very, what I thought was intriguing, observation. I was paying attention to stress. I would ask people about their stress, and what I found out is that it didn't seem that stress was the critical issue. Let me see if I can explain. You see, my practice is in the Silicon Valley of California, where there are a lot of can-do, get-it-done, entrepreneurial kind of people. And that's the spirit in this area, that people push themselves to get things done. Well, when I would talk to them about their illness, what I noticed is they didn't get sick when they had something to do, when they had some challenge that they wanted to try and meet. They became ill when the stress was over.
Okay.
Repeatedly. I saw this cycle of illness, that people became sick when the stress was over.
Okay,
Does that resonate for you?
That really seems counterintuitive, though, because you don't expect to hear that. You expect that when the stress is over, you start to feel better, not worse.
You would think that, and that's why I talk to people, and I listen to them, and that's not what happens. People get sick when the stress is over. And I give lots of examples in the book. There are ways of thinking about it that you may have even heard of. For example, have you heard people talk about Blue Death?
Yes.
Yeah, so
but talk death, about that. Tell the audience what that is.
Well, yes. So Blue Death is the concept that the firemen and the policemen who wear the blue uniforms, when they become ill, is when they retire in their 60s and slow down, they don't live very long thereafter. So they call it Blue Death, as if it's, the concept is that, well, something about the stress that they were under And then, well, wait a minute. If it was the stress that we're under, why did it wait until the stress was over, when they chose to retire, when they allowed themselves to slow down? Why did they die then? You see, that's what I kept asking over and over when I would see people in the office, and I would say, so what was the situation? And they would describe to me that it wasn't when they had something to get done, it was when they slowed down. Another reason why I didn't think it was stress, especially related to the Blue Death, is I would ask firemen and policemen, so you have a stressful job, are you stressed? And they'd look at me and say, doctor, I don't know about what you're talking about, stress. You know, I do what I have to do. I'm a fireman. 24-hour shifts, that's nothing. Back-to-back shifts, that's what we do.
Interesting.
In other words, what was happening, it seems, is that they were pushing themselves to get things done, but when they slowed down and allowed themselves to retire, that's when they became ill. That's when they died.
So it almost sounds like they had all their defense mechanisms working while physically as well as emotionally while they were working in their jobs, and when they let those mechanisms down, then there was space for the illness to come in. Is that what you're saying?
Right. What I noticed when I talked to firemen and policemen and single moms, for example, or these entrepreneurial can-do kind of people, the second thing I noticed that I thought was very interesting is that they had a peculiar response to what most people call a stress or a challenge. I would talk to them about it, and they would say that if they had something that they needed to get done, and they made up their mind they were going to do it, something would happen. They would actually feel as if they got more energy to get it done. They became more confident and more creative. And whatever it was that they decided they were going to do, they felt as if they had extra energy. And that's the clue that made me realize that something peculiar was going on. Because the first law of thermodynamics, the first law of science, is there's no such thing as extra energy. But I believe them. I believe the single mom when she says, oh, doctor, I have to do it. There's nobody else to do it. I have to do it for my family. I have to work a double shift, and I'm going to get it done. And there's no doubt. And I talked to them about this situation where they'd get more energy, and then they would talk to me about what it felt like, and I found it very interesting. And that's what I talked about in the book, this extra energy experience. I don't know if that makes sense to you.
Absolutely. Sort of like second wind, right? You're exhausted.
You got it, exactly. Second wind. People talk about that.
Apps all the time.
Right. And what I did is I asked people about this second wind experience that they would get, and I asked them to characterize it for me. Tell me all about it. You see, one of the things I most enjoyed about my practice is as a solo practitioner here in Santa Clara, the Silicon Valley, I had the opportunity to spend as much time with my patients listening to their stories. And that's what I enjoyed most. And they talked to me about what it was like to have extra energy. And as a result of listening to them, I created an acronym that describes the characteristics of this second wind experience. I call it accelerated, and each letter stands for one of the characteristics that people talk to me about.
Now, accelerated is a pretty long word for an acronym. So what what's going into this acronym? What are you talking about? What are you seeing?
Okay. Well, so what I would do is I would say to patients, so when you have this experience, let's use my acronym accelerated, and you describe to me whether or not during this experience you have those kinds of feelings. And so the A stands for they feel like your mind is more active. And they would say, yeah, I get more active. And the C is for more confidence. Oh, yeah, I'm going to get it done. I got to get it done. And the second C is for more creative. And the E is for more energy. Well, we talked about that. Sometimes they call it extra energy. And the L stands for less sleep and less food even. In other words, while they're having this experience of second wind, they have less need for the things that usually make us feel well. Less need for food. They'd work right through lunch, wouldn't even miss it. right? That's and you can get by with less sleep and still function at a very high level. In fact, that's what you have to do to be a fireman, right?
Absolutely.
Right, they do double shifts, and they but if there's an emergency, they step up and they're focused and they help us, right? So the L was for less sleep. The second E was for more entrepreneurial. And by that I mean that they would describe that they could put resources together in a novel kind of way to make some end come about that they had in mind. So a different way to put together their finances or a different way to solve a problem. I would include that under entrepreneurial.
Okay.
In other words, the things that it takes to get something done.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And the, let's see, the R stands for Randy. Now, Randy is a British expression, but I needed an R, so I went with it. But the idea is that a kind of a preoccupation with things that are pleasurable. In other words, things that make you feel good. When people have this second wind kind of experience, they're more interested in things that are fun. For example, at night, when people get a second wind and they call themselves a night owl, if they watch one of those late night talk show programs, they're more funny at night. But if you watch that during the day, not so much.
Interesting.
So during the second wind experience, people seem to have more preoccupation with things that are fun and feel pleasurable.
So,
and the A stands for more articulate. That's when people become more chatty when they have this second wind. In fact, if you would think about second wind in terms of what people feel at night when they stay up a little long and they get this second wind of things that they want to do, that's when people become more chatty and more talkative and more social. The T is for more titanic. They feel strong. And the third E is for enthusiastic and entertaining. In other words, more charismatic. The concept I have is that when people have this accelerated experience, they have more of what it takes to become leaders, to become the alphas of the group, to get something done, to have people get in line with them, to follow them, and to achieve. And the D is for more determined. They become more focused on what they have to do and determined to do it. And that's what accelerated is about.
So except for that little minor detail about less sleep, I mean, what's not to like, quite frankly, with accelerated?
Right, exactly. Well, let's talk about that. So the idea I came up with is that I realized that there could not be extra energy. There's no such thing. But people told me that they felt like they had more of what it takes to be a leader, more of what it takes to solve a problem, more of what it takes to help their family. So I said to myself, well, it can't be extra. I decided they were borrowing. I call it, when a person is in a second wind mode, when they're accelerated, I call it energy borrowing. They're borrowing it. And when I ask people, I say, hey, so this extra energy you get, where do you think it comes from? And I don't know, Dr. Brewer, if you ever had a second wind experience, but if you've ever had it, maybe you've also had the idea that you get this extra energy and then would ask yourself, where does it come from?
Well, you know, who would stop to ask, where am I getting this energy from? You don't. You just are appreciative of the fact that you have this energy that you feel as though you need to do whatever the thing is that you want to do. But when you put it in the concept of energy borrowers, so then I immediately think, well, when you borrow something, you got to pay it back.
There you go.
You can't keep it.
Right. So the idea I was telling, that when I asked them, where does it come from, this energy, they say, well, things like, you know what, it comes from determination and from the power of mind, and it comes from motivation. And I said, well, okay, that's fair, but do you think it's free? And then everybody knows there's no free. There's no free. You're going to have to pay for it some kind of way. So if you have extra energy, the concept I'm trying to teach people is that you're borrowing it from your immune system, the very part of you whose job it is to keep you healthy and to keep you alive, and you're borrowing it. You decided that there's an emergency that you need to solve, and you step up, and you use the power of mind to push yourself to get it done. Now, you may not be thinking of it that way, but that's the concept I'm describing. You decide to get it done.
When you put it in those terms, that you're borrowing it from your immune system, then I start to have a different thought. And then I want to, I'm hesitating now, and I'm thinking, well, I want to give it back to my immune system. Can I just sleep extra tomorrow?
It turns out, yes, you can.
I like that.
Yeah. That's actually what I end up having to teach my patients who are, for example, single moms who don't have any other choice. They have to get it done. So then I teach them the principles of wellness. But before I do that, I first have to convince people, as you suggested, very few people are willing to stop and ask, where am I getting this extra energy from? Is there going to be a cost for this? Because in the context of Silicon Valley, for example, where people sleep is thought of as a second thought, the idea is, you know what, I'll sleep when I'm dead.
Exactly.
Right now, I'm going to get things done. And the concept that I'm dealing with is trying to help people to understand that if you push yourself and you borrow energy from your sleep, from your immune system, you are going to have to pay back. Because what happens is, Dr. Brewer, when I ask people to look at any time in their life when they became ill, they could pick a appendicitis or a migraine or a flu, or any time they become ill, and ask themselves what I call the quick sick question. When you became ill, the week before, were you engaged in something that you were doing that you had to energy borrow, you had to do more and sleep less? And then within a day of your deciding that you could slow down, that's when you became ill? Then they can easily answer for themselves that this pattern of this cycle of energy borrowing, getting by with less sleep than what's really healthy, is going to work out in the long run.
Now, if I understand you correctly, though, what you just said a few moments ago is that I can actually make up that energy that I've borrowed. Can I actually sleep more on Saturday and make up for all the sleep I didn't get Monday through Friday?
All the sleep? No. But yes, you can make up. And the concept that people have that you can't catch up on your sleep, they're mistaken.
Oh, that's a very different perspective from what we hear, I would suggest, in the broader society.
Oh, really? Describe to me what it is that you've heard, and perhaps I can elucidate it, I can help.
That you can't make up sleep. The sleep, once it's gone, it's gone. And that whatever
that's
you
so
do...
so far from true.
Okay.
You know, Dr. Brewer, anyone that has children knows better. All you have to do is, I'm suggesting that people do what I do, and that's observe what happens in life. You know, if you have a child, and your child goes to spend the weekend with grandmother, and then comes back to your house on Monday, and is acting all weird, and then you realize, you know what, at grandma's house, she got out of her sleep schedule, and she got less sleep. Grandma let her stay up. Or maybe someone goes over, one of your children goes over to a sleepover at someone else's house, and then they come back and they're all cranky and irritable, and you say to yourself, you know what, they didn't get enough sleep. And then you make it a point to make sure that your daughter gets her sleep again that night. So she comes back to your house, and you get her to go to bed early, and get her bath, and get her in her cotton jammies, and she goes to bed early, and she sleeps a lot the next day, and she feels a lot better. She sleeps extra that night. And does she feel better the next day? Yes. But does she feel completely better? No. It takes a couple of days of sleeping extra to make up for that, what we call a sleep debt. And every parent has seen it and knows that if their child stays up too long, they have to pay back their sleep debt. And it takes a while to pay back the sleep debt, but you can do it.
Interesting.
Does that resonate for you?
Well, it sounds like it could give folks permission not to get the quality sleep they need during the week. And so
I was hesitant.
Okay. Let me interrupt us for a moment because we need to take a break. But when we come back, I want to pick up right here on this issue of making it up and it being okay.
Okay.
This is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk, and I'm having a fascinating conversation with Dr. Roger Washington, who is the author of Lack of Sufficient Sleep Matters, Decode the Root Cause of Your Illness. We'll be right back. Dr. Washington, you say that sleep deprivation is, and I am quoting you, the elephant in the room of modern medicine. And so I take that comment and I think about those folks I know who will routinely sleep 4 hours a night and pride themselves with the notion that I only need 4 or 5 hours of sleep. I'm just fine. So is that an example of the sleep deprivation that's the elephant in the room?
Well, yes, that's an extreme example. However, those people who say that I'm just fine, they're not really looking at the broader picture. They're not looking at what happens in the future. And they're only answering the question, how much sleep do I need to keep going?
Exactly.
You see, that's different.
Exactly,
When patients ask me, Dr. Washington, how much sleep do I need? I continue to wait. I want to hear, how much sleep do you need to be healthy? Or how much sleep do you need to keep going? Because what varies from person to person, and the energy borrowers are better at it, is that the energy borrowers can get by with less sleep and still function at a fairly high level. But everyone is somewhat impaired if they don't get as much sleep as they could, if they haven't carry any what we call sleep debt. And one of the prime examples of the people that you describe who pride themselves on how little sleep they need, and I devote a chapter to a person I greatly admire, Bill Clinton, in my book, where I describe that when Bill Clinton was in college, he said, when I'm the president, in other words, he applied what they call the power of positive thinking, when I'm the president, not if I was the president, this is what I would do. And if you're from Arkansas and you have divorce and alcohol in your family, you're not supposed to become the president of the United States, but he outworked everyone. He had many of the characteristics of people that I described and accelerated, and he only needed 4 hours of sleep to keep going. And he became one of the youngest presidents we've ever had, and he did 2 terms. And after his terms as president, he wrote a big book, an autobiography. Then he went on a campaign to sell the book and tell people about it. And all the time, he had exams done by some of the best doctors in the country. You have to have that when you're the president. However, after the Democratic National Convention in June, which was the culmination of his political career, he was the keynote speaker. He no longer did tours for his book. Within weeks, he was 57 years old, and he had quadruple bypass surgery. In other words, when the man slowed down, that's when he, what I call crashed and burned, which is another acronym I have. But the idea is, when he slowed down, that's when he, had he not had some of the best doctors on the planet taking care of him, when he had quadruple bypass surgery and complications, he might have died then. In other words, the same thing that happens to the firemen and the policemen and the career military officers who get by with so little sleep. Then you ask them, how does it go in the future? Right. Then they pay the price.
And so clearly, even though, I mean, you almost refer to him as a poster child for another one of your acronyms, which is LOSS, lack of sufficient sleep, in that, as you say, he was doing fine, it seemed like. And then it seemed like out of the blue, all of a sudden, he had this significant surgery. So for someone like him, who probably is a 3-4, or at least was a 3-4-5 hour a night sleeper, how do they begin to shift into a different pattern? And what do they really need to understand about this chronic 3-4-5 hour a night sleep pattern that they're in? Why is it so well, you're not saying that it's potentially harmful. You're saying it is harmful.
No doubt. No doubt it is harmful. What I'm suggesting is that a person who wanted to shift, well, that's the first question. Why would you want to shift? As you suggested earlier, what's not to like about being accelerated? What's not to like about becoming the president of the United States, if that's what it takes? But there's a cost. And so what I would explain to people is that you gravitate towards that which you secretly love most. And if your goal is to enjoy being accelerated and not sleep, well, there's going to be a cost to your health. If you decide that you want to sleep, then you would have to take a different approach to the accelerated experience and know that you have the potential to become accelerated as a part of your perhaps genetic makeup. You have the, but you don't have to do it. You don't have to use it. You don't have to use it all the time and perhaps abuse it, but that's the choice that people have. I'm trying to help people to understand that it is a choice and that they shouldn't inadvertently do it, because very often people get a second wind by mistake, or I'm sorry, not by mistake, but inadvertently. For example, when people stay up at night, very often they get this night owl experience, and they think that it's a good thing. They think it's their, what, they think it's part of their genetic makeup, perhaps, to be a night owl and not a morning person. And I'm teaching them that no, the night owl experience is a part of the accelerated experience of which will then lead to crashing and burning.
You know, as we're talking about the need for reasonable sleep and to not live in the accelerated lane, for example, I think about the students in med school. They're not getting a lot of sleep at all. And they, one would think more than anyone, would understand the downfall of not getting sufficient sleep. So what's that about? They know, they should know. Do they know? Is it the curriculum? Is it the students? Is it the administration? How does that happen?
Well, as you suggested earlier, if a person had the ability to become accelerated, they would enjoy it. They would take advantage of it. They would use it to their own ends, be able to stay up and study more and pass exams. And as you said, what's not to like? In other words, the point of becoming accelerated, it gives you more confidence. It makes you more entrepreneurial, more willing to take a risk. That's a good thing in an emergency. But what's happening is that no one before has ever noticed that there's a consequence.
I see.
That's what I'm trying to tell people.
I see.
That there's a consequence. And it's not a coincidence that doctors have the highest suicide rate of anyone in the population. It's not a coincidence. When I say that people crash and burned is what happens to people on the weekend after they finish the big project. Or it happens to women after their menstrual cycle, the estrogen allows them to be more accelerated. And when the estrogen goes away at the end of the cycle, they become crashed and burned. And the acronym stands for, C stands for crash, like they hit a wall. The R stands for reclusive, like they feel like they want to be left alone. The A stands for irritable and a little bit angry. The S is for feeling like sleep changes. They either want to sleep a lot or they can't sleep at all. The H is for hunger, because they either feel like they get the munchies and want to get comfort food, or they don't want to eat. The E is for feeling empty, as if somebody pulled the plug. And D is for feeling depressive, as if the brain doesn't operate as sharply as it does, and they feel a little more emotional and a little bit more sensitive. The B in burn is for bumming. I don't know if you remember that one, but the idea that things seem, they don't seem so good. The U is for unmotivated. The R is for restrained, because the brain feels restrained. I can't think as sharply as I usually feel. The N is for feeling negative. Like, oh, why did you say that to me? Are you angry? The E is for feeling empty. And the D in crash and burned is for death, because that's when people start having negative feelings about life and what's it all worth and uselessness. And doctors who do too much accelerating and sleeping too little get by with it and have wonderful careers, but later on in life, they too suffer from the what goes up must come down. And the D stands for death. And you ask, why don't doctors appreciate it? Well, it's almost like a untalked about secret, like a dirty little secret, that doctors have such a high suicide rate.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, people don't think about that at all, but we know, as you say, that is true. You also just said you've said in your book that you take a great deal of pride in diagnosing and treating depression. And a moment ago, you talked about the experience of depression for folks who are in the crash and burn stage.
That's right.
Talk about the pride that you take in diagnosing and treating depression.
Well, when it's almost like returning a person, giving people their life back. When you successfully treat someone for a depression, and it's difficult to describe, but anyone who's ever had prescription glasses and the doctor gives you the new glasses and $250 for them, and you finally put them on and you realize how crystal clear things are, it's like, wait a minute, how come I didn't appreciate this before? Well, it's hard to describe for people what 2020 looks like until you put the glasses on. And when people are mired in depression, they feel like it's normal for them. But then when, as a result of the work that we do, depression lifts and they feel normal, then it's as if they have their life back. And it's very gratifying. It's why I went into medicine, to be able to have that kind of experience with clients. But what I'm trying to get across to people is that the depression that people experience is a part of the accelerated experience. One goes with the other. What goes up must come down. If a child stays up too late in the evening and doesn't get enough sleep, the next day you have an irritable, cranky, moody, negative child that can't perform in the way she usually performs. Well, what is that if it's not depressed?
Gotcha.
Right? But a mother knows talking to that child's not going to help. Punishing the child isn't going to make a difference, but mom knows if she gets that baby some sleep, she'll have her regular baby back. After one day of poor sleep, there's a rebound, crashed and burned kind of feeling. But as a result of weeks and months of too much acceleration, I think that's what causes people to become crashed and burned, and the crashed and burned is the negative side, the depressive side.
Mm-hmm.
Does that resonate?
Yes, absolutely. You is there a minimum or a maximum amount in general that you would like to see children and adults get? And I'm assuming it's different for children than adults, but perhaps not.
Well, actually, I think the first place I try to begin with people is to help them understand that sleep is not for rest. People think, no, sleep for children, sleep is for growth. You bring the baby home from the hospital and she sleeps for 20 hours. She's not resting. She's growing. And that's work. And when the baby grows, that's they grow when they're in deep sleep. But as adults, we don't need to grow. We need to make repairs. And when we get our deep sleep, that's when we make the repairs. And so I would say to someone whose goal is to be healthy, why would you cheat the repairs? Why would you get less sleep? And then I'd have to explain to them something else that I want to have people understand. It's very important that no one can sleep more than they need.
No one can.
It's not possible.
Okay.
Now, people think, oh, no, if a person's lazy, they could just sleep. And no, that's not true. If that were true, then people would in jail would just sleep the whole sentence away.
That's true.
Right? They just
that's
go to sleep.
True.
And when
right.
I wake up, I'm out.
Right.
No. The point is, science has, I believe in the scientific method, science has taught us that a person cannot sleep more than what they need. If you let a person sleep and sleep and sleep and they sleep and sleep and sleep, and let's say for several days you let them get enough sleep, and then they wake up, you could pay them $1 million. Go back to sleep. Can't do it. Once you've slept enough, you can't sleep more. Anyone who feels sleepy, it's because they have sleep debt.
Sleepy equals sleep debt.
That's correct.
Now, you've just said that you can't sleep more than you need.
That's correct.
So I'm going to go back to the person who prides themselves in sleeping 4 or 5 hours a night.
Yes.
And they're going to say, I woke up 4 hours into my sleep. I just woke up. I can't go back to sleep. That means yes. I've had enough?
No, that doesn't mean they have had enough. Dr. Brewer, what that means is that they've trained themselves to get by on four.
Okay.
Remember I said, I tried to start off by saying that when a person makes up their mind as to what they want to do, that's what's going to happen. You gravitate towards that which you secretly love most. That's a George Clinton line that I learned back in the day. The idea is that if a person decides that they want to wake up at 6 o'clock in the morning, they set the clock for 6, I got to get on that plane. I'm waking up at 6. Very often people have had the experience that at 5:59, their eyes will pop open,
that's
they'll
true.
Look at the alarm and say, oh, I woke up just in time.
Right.
Right? That's the power of positive thinking. That proves, I think, that a person can control how they sleep by what they tell themselves. So all those people that you told me about that say, oh, well, I wake up after 4 hours, you trained yourself to wake up after 4 hours.
I see.
You've been doing it for a while. That's what you want. That's what you got. And you're going to get the negative consequences with your health, too, by the way.
So is there a minimum amount of sleep that one, that an adult should get? And is there
to
a
healthy?
Yeah.
8 minimum.
8 minimum for an adult.
Right. So I would go against the grain. I am outside the mainstream. I would have to admit that I would go against the grain of the doctors and the sleep specialists who say that on average, a person needs between seven and eight hours of sleep or something along those lines. What I would say is what those people did is they looked at what most people do in the United States. And that's how much most people sleep. So let's call that normal. I don't believe that's how you describe what's normal. I believe that's how you describe what people do, what's common, but I wouldn't want to confuse that with what's healthy. And there are a number of good studies that have shown that if you leave people alone or put them in caves where they don't have access to lights or with clocks, and what people do in that circumstance, the human body tends to sleep for about 8 hours. Out of the 24.
Interesting.
And I find that to be most healthy. And I think that there's a study that I think you might find interesting, Dr. Brewer, where they saw that there are people who are short sleepers, their health is not so great. And the people who are long sleepers, their health is not so great. But the people who sleep about 8 hours have wonderful health. And the other thing I would also tell people, and I tell them in my book, lack of sufficient sleep matters. If you find someone who's 80, right? So I believe you prove to yourself, you find someone who's 80 and lives in their own home and tells jokes and takes care of themselves, ask that person about their sleep. And what you're going to hear is a love story, because that person gets sleep very often you read in the newspaper where someone lived to be 90 years old or 95, and then people ask them, well, what did you do? And they'll say something strange like, well, I like to have a glass of alcohol now and then, and occasionally I would. And it seems all over the map as to what helped them to live long. But if you ask them about their sleep, I'm suggesting you'll hear a love story. These are people who made sure that they got their sleep. They listened to their bodies.
Interesting.
If you want to know about sleep, that's how you find out about it.
Dr. Washington, we're going to take a break, and when we come back, we will continue with this really fascinating look at how we want to think about and embrace the use of sleep as a healing tool. Folks, this is Pamela Brewer. You're listening to Mind Talk. Don't go away. Dr. Washington, you've said that for an adult, really 8 hours is a minimum. Is that the same for children and adolescents?
No. Children are growing, and the more they're growing, the more sleep they need. Very small children will sleep most of the day, whereas an adolescent needs about 9 to 10 hours of sleep in order to grow and to be healthy. I would stick to that, and I would ask any mother to look at her own experience with her children and notice that when they come home, say an adolescence during the summer months, when they spend more time sleeping, they seem to have a growth spurt, right? As I think a mother who's interested in having her children be optimally healthy will make sure that they get all the sleep they actually need. Does that help to understand it?
Absolutely, and I think it's very helpful to the parents who are listening, who don't have the information that you're sharing with us today. You also say that there are different types of sleep. You say there's baby deep sleep and problem solving sleep.
Yes.
What's the difference?
Well, the baby deep sleep is the sleep that people get when they first go to sleep. It's very deep. Parents have the experience that when the baby falls asleep on the couch or in the car, they can carry him up to the bedroom and turn him upside down and put their pajamas on. They're out. They're not going to wake up. That's when we are most vulnerable. That's the sleep during which the human growth hormone is released into the body that helps us grow. That's most people have the experience that if they fall asleep in the evening, they tend to sleep for several hours before they wake up, because the body is designed to do that critical maintenance first during the deep sleep when we'd be most vulnerable, for example, our ancestors. And the idea is that that's the sleep that's most important to health. Later on during the night, we tend to have more dream sleep where we solve problems and figure things out. And unfortunately, what I'm having to teach people is that those people who stay up too late and become night owls, to some extent, they're forfeiting much of their deep regenerative sleep. You know, a lot of engineers, they say to me, well, doctor, if I stay up till midnight and I sleep until 8, I got 8 hours, that should work. No, you'd like it to work, but no, I'm afraid that doesn't work. The body wasn't designed that way. We're creatures of the sun. We're our bodies are designed to work around the way the sun works.
So 12 to 8 would not work. I think about the shift workers who are working all kinds of odd shifts all the time. What's going to work for them?
Well, actually, it's not a very good trade. They do tend to get a 10%, 15% differential in pay for working late, but we know that people who work shift work have the worst kind of health. Women, for example, that do shift work have threefold at least incidence of breast cancer. It's not healthy. And what I've been trying to teach people is something I call the Washington Sleep Loss Principle. And what it suggests is that illness is related to activity. If you have more activity, then you need more sleep to balance it. So activity and sleep need to stay in a healthy ratio. Every mother knows that if her child has a big day and goes to the park and goes swimming in the amusement park and party that evening, the child tends to fall asleep early and gets more sleep that night in order to naturally stay in balance. And we need to do that as well. If you have more activity, then you need more sleep. That's why I say 8 hours minimum. But those people who disobey the principle, who do more activity and sleep less, well, they're a setup for becoming ill. And they're going to become ill when they slow down. That's the gist of what I call my Washington sleep loss principle.
Are there illnesses that you see that automatically you begin to wonder about their sleep patterns, or does it always require some digging?
Dr. Brewer, most illness is a result of lack of sufficient sleep. That's why I suggested that if a person used the sick question and picked any illness that they can remember when they became sick, came after a period of doing too much with too little sleep. You know, for example, you talked about the germs. When people go to the bank, they don't wash their hands after they touch the money. And when you go to a restaurant, I don't think you see people lined up at the restroom to wash their hands first. And when you sit down at the table, I don't know that some industrious restaurant worker cleaned that salt shaker before you got there. And yet we all touch these things, but we don't get sick all the time. No, if the germs are there all the time, and what about your genes? Yeah, some people have the gene to become diabetic. Some people get it at 40, some people at 60. You can't change your genes. I'm suggesting that lack of sleep is what causes the illness to come out earlier than later. I'm suggesting that lack of sleep and the energy borrowing from our immune systems makes us susceptible to the germs that were around. An example I'd like to give you, if you don't mind,
sure.
As a mother who is taking care of her baby, who's sick, in addition to everything else she has to do, she has to get up during the night and check on the baby, give them the medication, the cough, make sure they're warm enough, right? So she's sacrificing her sleep to take care of the baby, right? And it's not until the baby starts to become, maybe sees the doctor and gets on the antibiotic, then mom becomes sick. Why doesn't mom become sick while she's taking care of the baby and the baby's still in things are a little bit precarious? No. As long as the mom has something she's got to get done, she's going to energy borrow. And then when she's done, the rubber band snaps back and she becomes susceptible to the germs that she's around. I'm suggesting that lack of sleep is the critical cause of most of what we consider to be disease. There are some classic diseases like migraine that come as a result of lack of sleep. That's pretty obvious, I think, if people start to ask themselves, what time of day do they get their migraine? What day of the week do they get their migraine? What's going on when they get their migraine?
Interesting. You tell an amusing story about yourself and
yes.
How you have a little tell when you're getting tired that you've asked your family to be on the lookout for.
Right. I tell that in the context of driving. My mentor, Dr. Dement, who taught us much about sleep, used to say driving while drowsy is red alert. And what I would tell my family is that, and friends, is that when I start to become a little drowsy for some reason I scratch my head. And it's a immediate sign that, oh, I'm getting sleepy. Now, some people yawn or they stretch. I may do that too, but if I scratch my head, it usually means that I'm getting drowsy. And what I've told them is if I do it, then someone else needs to drive because I'm going to try to man up and push through, but I don't want to take that chance with my family. So I've given them permission that if they notice it, then Papa needs to get some sleep.
What are some of the first steps that you would like folks to take? As folks have been listening to our conversation, I think it's pretty clear those who are borrowing energy and really not treating their bodies as well as they treat their cars or their computers often. So now they've got a real clear sense that they need to do something. What is the something that they need to do? I'm thinking that you can't miraculously go from 4 hours a night of sleep to 8 hours just overnight, or can you?
You can.
You can.
That's the whole point of mind over matter. That's the whole point of deciding what your priorities are in life and going after them. The thing about can-do people is that when they make up their mind to get something done, it's getting done. Come hell or high water, it's getting done. And so the first thing a person would have to do is decide what their priorities really are. The people who want to compromise, they're going to have difficulty. But the people who decide that, no, I want to make my health the priority, or more likely, the mothers and the parents who decide, I want to make my children's health a priority, they will change it overnight. There'll be a new rule when the children come home from school. We're getting back to basics. You're going to go outside and play. You're going to get out from underneath that television. You're going to be active. And when you start to get tired this evening, you're going to bed, young man, young lady. You're going to bed. That's the rule. And they can change overnight.
So the good news is that for all of the harm that many of us have done our bodies by virtue of a lack of sleep, this is not something where you have to take a test and wait a week for the results or take a pill and hope that you can afford to buy the pill. This is something that you can do on your own tonight, right now.
That's right. I often tell people to give themselves permission because that's where it starts. Anyone who's been at school or done something that was arduous and difficult for a period of time, they might come home on a Friday and get, I call it sleeping like you did when you were in your mama's house. You come home from and you tell yourself, you know what, I had a long week. I'm just going to bed. I'm not getting up tomorrow. That's how it starts, with a decision. And then you go to bed, and then the next morning, people usually wake up according to their usual time, and they look at the clock, and they say, no, I'm not getting up. And they go back to sleep. And then maybe an hour later, 90 minutes later, they wake up again, and they look at the light coming through the window, and you're in your mom's house, so you say to yourself, you don't have a shred of guilt. Nope, I'm going back to sleep. And then they sleep, and they sleep, and until they finally can't sleep anymore. And maybe they wake up at noon, and they've slept for 14 or whatever number of hours it is, and they can't sleep anymore. And they notice, wow, that was good. Right. Notice then how you feel. Right? Because it started with giving yourself permission and telling your brain that this is what we're going to do. And then your brain will do the rest. It will get you the good sleep that you need to help pay back this sleep debt. And that's how it starts.
You know, it's on the one hand, what you're saying, I'm sure it will be startling to some people that when you say that most illness has at least some basis in how much sleep you do or don't get. But the hopeful thing, as you've just described, is that you can change that, and you can change that right now tonight. And that's extraordinary. And that's very hopeful.
Well, it is a story of hope. But it starts with recognizing what the problem is, and recognize that it starts with attitudes and your beliefs about sleep and your beliefs about health. And so I'm trying to get people to first recognize how this lack of sleeping and this accelerated experience that people have lead to illness later. The next day, when people wake up in the morning feeling tired and feeling like they need coffee and sugar to keep them going, but yet they want to claim that they're not a morning person, well, yeah, then they wouldn't have needed those drugs to get themselves going then, I would say.
Gotcha.
And the people in the afternoon who get what we call food coma and get a little irritable, a little tired, and not doing their best work, they want to claim that they're, well, what is that? Right? That's when the person who slept 4 hours, that's when you're going to notice that they're not at their best. Don't go to your boss who sleeps only 4 hours and ask him for a raise at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. That's not a good idea.
Gotcha. Roger Washington, author of Lack of Sufficient Sleep Matters, Decode the Root Cause of Your Illness. Thank you so much for this book, certainly, but thank you for spending time with us today to explain to us the true importance and value and power of getting quality sleep.
I've enjoyed it. Thank you, Dr. Brewer.
My pleasure. And folks, thank you for joining us on this edition of Mind Talk. Remember, you can listen to this edition of this program or any other Mind Talk program on demand anytime at myndtalk.org. That's myndtalk.org. Mind Talk is a daily public service, educational public service that is made available to you and is not intended to replace any work that you might choose to do with a medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Bram and 26x2 Communications. If you would like to be in touch with me, by all means, you can do so through the mindtalk.org website. And again, that's myndtalk.org. And folks, also, always, actually, you know what, folks? I want to interrupt myself because it occurs to me, Dr. Washington, that you have a website for the book. Would you share that with the audience very quickly?
Well, I said that A Lack of Sufficient Sleep Matters is the name of the book. In fact, if you go to sleepmatterthebook.com, you can download a free chapter that describes the accelerated experience in more depth. And people can certainly purchase the book there.
So sleepmatterthebook.com is the place to go?
That is, to get Lack of Sufficient Sleep Matters.
Okay, wonderful. And thank you for joining us on this edition of Mind Talk. Mind Talk is brought to you daily as an educational public service, and it is not intended to replace any work that you may choose to do with a medical, mental health, or other professional. Mind Talk is available on demand at mindtalk.org. That's myndtalk.org. Mind Talk is produced by Jim Brown and 26x2 Communications. If you would like to be in touch with me directly, that number is 301-654-5286. But the best way to be in touch is at myndtalk@aol.com. And remember always, if it's unacceptable, it's unacceptable. Take care.